Well, thanks for coming out on a Tuesday night. And for those of you who don't know me, I'm Ken Crystal. I'm a professor of law and the director of the Environmental and Natural Resources Law Clinic at the Delaware Law School up in Wilmington. What I do at the law school is I teach and I operate the clinic, which litigates and advises clients on environmental matters. I teach environmental law, but the thing that I teach every year is property law. And one of the segments, actually, that I teach in property law is about zoning. So this kind of what we're talking about tonight is something that is part of what I teach. The property law classes are 60 to 70 students. And one semester a year, I get about 10 to 12 students in the clinic, and I assign them different tasks. One of the tasks, for example, two students worked on this semester was updating the Citizen's Guide. The Citizen's Guide, in fact, was the handiwork, at least the first draft of it was, the handiwork of students. And I then edited it and made it into the book. So we train students to be lawyers, and we happen to do that with environmental law, with students who are interested in doing things like representing clients who have environmental issues. But the goal of the clinic is to provide that representation, but really to get our students ready to be lawyers. And so they work with real clients on real matters and see how the process works. And those matters can be litigation, so we do lots of appeals of permits or decisions that are made by governmental agencies. We advise clients on how to proceed and deal with problems. We do educational things like creating guides. So we do a variety of different things, and the students hopefully get this a little glimpse of what it's like to be a practicing lawyer before they go out into the real world. And that's what my function is in running the clinic. Because I only get clinic students for a semester, a lot of the work that's done in the clinic is done by me. It's like I'm a solo practitioner who focuses on environmental law and the representation of clients who have environmental issues. I love doing it. I spent 18 years on the dark side, and this is now karmic justice that I get to spend. I'm now finishing up my 18th year on the good side, and so I've at least balanced that out and hopefully have at least a couple more years to work up my positive karma. Okay, so today I wanted to talk to you about zoning because that's an issue. You know, this presentation was actually intended to happen in spring of 2020. And I don't know, something happened. It got delayed. But the effect of that was, because when you know, it was after the Citizen's Guide, the first draft or the first edition, if you will, came out. And in doing that first edition, I said, you know what, zoning is like a whole nother world. I can't talk about that. And so the original edition just had stuff about state environmental law. And what the pandemic allowed us to do in the clinic was to include a zoning analysis. And now this past semester, we were able to expand it some more. So there's a lot more robust information about zoning in the state of Delaware as a result of this. So I get to talk to you about that today because that's really a big issue. And frankly, that's a place where the vast majority of time people first come into contact with projects that have environmental issues. And so it's in the context of zoning, and it makes sense to understand how the zoning process works. And where are the points of leverage that students or clients or attorneys can have in dealing with those issues? And as I thought about this talk, I thought of utilizing sort of the analogy to roadmaps. I'm sure that some of you remember the good old-fashioned roadmaps. I actually looked it up. You can still buy the paper fold-out maps that come down to that little, right? And I can remember as a kid that they used to have those for free in the gas station, right, in a rack, and you could get your map out of that. And I love maps because maps do a really good job. I'm a visual learner, and so when I look at a map, I can kind of see, okay, this is where things are at, this is where I'm going. Of course, I say that, and then I have to admit to you that I got scrambled on the way here, and I'm looking at Google Maps, and I think I was thinking I was going north when I was going south, and so anyway, but I got here. So, all right, so I want to use roadmaps, and I think it's helpful for a couple different reasons. First, well, we got to go up here. Okay, did it change?
No, try the arrows.
Try the arrows. Okay, we'll try that. Does that work? Nope. All right, hang on. We got a thing here. We're getting used to this. Let's try that. All right, there we go. All right. What's good about maps is that the function of maps, right, is to give us a lay of the land. We get to see what's out there. Right, and literally lay of the land, like if you get a topographical map, right, you can see this is where there's a mountain or a hill, and you know, and you can see those kinds of things. But maps tell us what's there. And so what we have to think about and what we have to pay attention to as we're going about on our journey. And maps also are helpful because they show us ways to get to where we want to be. And if you think of a map in terms of driving, you say, okay, well, you know what? There's usually a whole bunch of different ways I can get from point A to point B, right? Google Maps will always give you two choices. And I noticed recently that Google Maps now has the most fuel-efficient choice, which is very nice, okay? But they'll always give you a couple different choices, all right? And it tells you what you have to do, where you have to go. And I think that that's helpful when we want to think about a subject matter that's as complex as zoning and planning. So what maps also tell us, though, is a couple of what I think are two general rules. General rule number one, you have to pick the right map, right? You could have the greatest map of the state of Ohio, but it won't help you if you're driving in Maryland, right? Or in Delaware, right? You need to have the right map. And in environmental law, when we talk about environmental things, environmental issues pop up and are dealt with in different places that have their own maps. Right? There are local places where some environmental issues are dealt with. That's generally zoning or planning. Planning is sometimes, you know, subdivision, development. Those are different terms that you see about it, but that's what planning's about. We're going to talk some more about it in a minute. And then there's state-level roadmaps, all right? And the primary roadmap is through the permitting process that DENREC runs. And they have state statutes, they have regulations, right? In the zoning context, we have ordinances that govern. Same thing in the planning context, all right? But you could almost think of it as those are different states. And so if I want to talk about how am I going to navigate my way through the zoning process, I need to pick the zoning map and not the state permitting map. And what's important about that is that it's you know, a lot of times you see a project, right? Someone's going to, you know, build 500 homes over here. And you're like, oh my gosh, that's the worst thing in the world. Because of all the environmental damage it's going to cause, right? And so you want to think about it. You know, you're thinking of it as, look at all this stuff that's going to happen. And you want to talk about that. You want to go to the Planning Commission and say, don't approve this thing because it's going to do this, it's going to do that, it's going to have this adverse impact, right? What you have to recognize is that some of those places, some of those issues are on the roadmap, and some aren't. And so part of what picking the right map is about is recognizing what I call general rule number two, which is maps only tell you what's relevant about their map. Okay? If I want to say I want to drive from Millsboro to Wilmington, but I want to make a stop in Baltimore, all right, my map of Delaware isn't going to tell me how to get around Baltimore. All right? You have to understand what the limits are. And the biggest limit is there are certain issues that matter in a particular map. And if they aren't, if what you care about isn't on that list, it's not going to have a role to play in that particular map. Okay? So, an example. I'm really worried because this new, you know, someone wants to come in and they want to build a plant that's going to process chicken waste into, you know, methane or into some kind of a gas. I don't know. Any of those happening around here? And you say, oh my gosh, think of all the air emissions that are going to happen. This is going to generate all these kinds of air pollutants, and that's going to adversely impact people. We want to raise that issue. Don't let this thing be built. Well, guess what? We're going to see in a minute, but if you're using the zoning map or the planning map, air emissions aren't on the map. Okay? And so you raise that issue in front of the Planning Commission or you raise that issue in front of County Council, and they're going to be like, that's not our concern, right? We don't care about that issue because it's not on their map. Now, you want to raise that issue, the place to go raise that is in the state because DENREC has regulations that govern air emissions, and so that's the place where you need to raise that issue, all right? So it's counterintuitive on one level to say, if I'm in the zoning roadmap, there are only certain things I can talk about here, even though I got a whole bunch of other issues that I care about. But what makes you a more effective advocate is to understand this is what matters in zoning, and there's something else that matters in planning, and there's something else that matters at the state permitting level. And if I can know what those are, and I can talk about those issues that are on the map, I'm going to be a more effective advocate. Because they can't ignore me if I'm talking about the things that they have to think about and consider when making their decision. All right? How do I find out what's on the roadmap? How do I find out the issues that are relevant in a particular process? It's going to be in the statute or the ordinance or the regulation. It's going to identify things that have to occur, that have to be done, that have to be considered. And so those become the target issues that you use when you're advocating in that particular process. All right? Now, I'm not going to talk about the state stuff. Citizens Guide's got that because I'm here to talk about zoning. So let's talk about zoning. All right? First, let's understand the distinction between zoning and planning. Because there is a distinction. All right? Generally, zoning is about the use that is allowed on a particular parcel. If my parcel of land is zoned AR, right, in Sussex, agriculture residential, right, there are certain uses that I can do because it's AR zoning. And it's talking, and so we're trying to figure out, can I do this use? Can I use my property in this way given the zoning designation that exists? All right, we're going to talk about this a little bit more in a minute, but there's different concepts within the zoning world. There's the permitted use or the by right use. There's something that's called conditional uses. Maybe you can, maybe you can't. Okay? There are special uses. There are non-conforming uses, right? And then there's this concept of getting a variance, changing the rule about what is allowed to happen there. All right? But zoning is about the use of the property itself. Planning is about how the property is to be developed. All right? And the best way to think of planning is to think generally in terms of like a housing development. Okay? Well, planning says is, oh, you want to put 500 houses out here on this big parcel of land you've got? Okay. Well, in order to do that, we're going to require certain things of you. Right? Having streets and having, sewer disposal of some kind, and those kinds of issues. Right? Planning is about the rules that govern how someone is going to develop their property to do one of the uses that zoning allows them to do. Right? So it's about development and sort of the regulations that govern that. That's the planning world. And zoning is just about what are you allowed to do? All right? So, with that, let's get into a little bit more detail so hopefully it understands it a little bit better. All right, and I'm going to use Sussex since we're down here in Sussex. All right. For zoning, the general rule is you can only do those uses that are allowed for your parcel, right? How do I find out what's allowed? Well, if you actually go to the code, the ordinance, the zoning ordinance, it's chapter 115, all right? Chapter 115 has a whole bunch of articles that say, that cover all the different zoning district categories, agriculture, residential, light industrial, commercial district, right? You have all these different categories that are allowed. Whatever the category is, you are going to find a list in there which says, here are the uses that are allowed on a property that is zoned this particular zoning designation. And what you will find is that there are a lot of uses that you might not think of when you look at the category. For example, agricultural residential. It's not just farms and houses. Right? You could have churches. You could have all kinds of things. But because they're listed as this is allowed, that's called a permitted use. It's permitted by the ordinance. You can do one of these if you have an AR zoned piece of parcel. And because it's on the list, and therefore you can do it, the language that sometimes uses is called, it's a by right use. Because being on the list creates a right in the owner. And so by that right, the owner can do that. So you got AR property, you say, I want to build a house. By right, you can do that. Okay? Likewise, if I got a huge, 600-acre parcel, and it's zoned AR, I can build houses. Okay? And I can split it up. Right? That's where planning comes in. I can subdivide it into 500 or 600 parcels, each of which is going to have a house. That's how developments happen. Okay? So when a developer says, well, I'm just going to do the buy right thing, okay, well, whatever the ordinance allows them to do, they can do it. Right? So the permitted uses, that's just the language of the ordinance. It allows it to happen. But there are a couple of things about that, right? I mean, okay, I want to build a house, but I can't build a house that's like from property line to property line. Why? Because even though I'm allowed to build a house, I have to build it in compliance with other requirements, right? And what the ordinance imposes are setbacks. You have to be so far away from the property boundary, right? So setbacks are a very common thing. Sometimes density in the sense of how much of your property can be concrete, building, right? Impervious surface. The ordinance says that, right? So I want to build a house, but I got to comply with those requirements that are built into the ordinance, that are set forth in the ordinance. But if I do that, by right, I can build my house. Okay? What you are allowed to do is made, that call is made by planning and zoning. Right? They'll say, yes, you have to show them your plans, this is what I'm going to do, and they're going to look at it and they're going to say, okay, you got the right setbacks, you got the right density, you got the right, all the different things required, you're building a house, it's AR, sure, go ahead. Planning and zoning makes that call. All right? Conditional uses are uses that are allowed, but not automatically. They are not by right. Instead, you have to go get approval. All right? And in order to do that, right, there's a general process that's described as to how you go about getting a conditional use. And so you have to comply with that general process. It's in Article 24 of the ordinance. All right? You have to go comply with that. And then each article, agricultural, residential, business district, whatever it might be, is going to have some additional requirements as to what you need to do in order to have a conditional use. All right? Basically, what you have to do is you have to submit a preliminary plan, and the Planning Commission reviews it first. They say yay or nay, and then County Council is the ultimate decision maker as to whether or not you're going to get your conditional use. All right? Those are the fora that you're going to fight this fight in if you want to challenge somebody who wants a conditional use. All right. Yeah, go ahead, you.
Permitted use.
Yes.
In AR1, the subdivisions are permitted use to house dwellings.
Well,
however,
so. Yeah, okay.
We have public hearings and public comments.
Right, because in order to do the subdivision, you're going to have to go through the planning process as well. And that's where you're going to have the opportunity to have a public hearing and public comment.
Yes, so nowadays the by right and permitted use is discussed a lot in the planning and zoning and also at the council. One of the reasons is because the workforce housing ordinance, they say it's by right permitted use so that there's no public hearing. That's what they're saying now. So suddenly, well, the subdivisions are permitted use, but we go through the public hearing. Mm-hmm. But workforce housing, it is a permitted use, it's by right, so you don't have to go to the council or planning and zoning hearing, and they go straight to the site plan. That's what they said.
Well, but I guess we have to sort of separate out. If I have one lot and I want to build on it, the question is my zoning okay? Is it a permitted use listed in the zoning for my one lot? And you don't have to go to subdivision, right? And so Planning Commission makes that call, boom, it's done. And Planning Commission doesn't have, not Planning Commission, Planning and Zoning makes the call, and they don't have hearings, so they just say, yeah, you're allowed to do that. As soon as you start saying, I've got a whole bunch of lots, or I've got one big lot and I want to break it into a bunch of smaller lots, each of which is going to be workforce housing, now I am creating a subdivision. Now I have to go through the subdivision process. So if it's a single lot and they're doing it and it's permitted because it's on the list, you're right, there won't be a hearing. But as soon as they start to say I have more than one lot, or I'm going to break my one big lot in the smaller lots, and each one is going to have this on it, it may be permitted, it may be a permitted use, but in order to split that up, that process of dividing it up, that is subject to hearing before Planning Commission and then ultimately.
When they do apartments, they don't have it because it's a single owner. It's the, in this case, the owner is the issue. They're not planning for multiple owners with their proposed change. Sussex County is basically proposing a change that if someone's building apartments, right now it's mostly a conditional use in AR districts.
Okay.
They want to make it a permitted use, and because it is a single owner, so he won't be subdividing it, he's just putting multiple structures on it, he doesn't necessarily have to go to planning and zoning hearings.
Yeah, okay, because if it's no longer a conditional use, you're taking it out of the conditional use category, and so you don't have to go through this process of Planning Commission and County Council.
It's a zoning called the Workforce Housing Zone, and that the developer has to set aside 30% of all the units as workforce housing for the low-income families.
Okay.
So that's a special zone they are creating. They keep saying this is permitted use by right, no public hearing, no comments.
I'd have to see the legislation to see what.
Oh, that'd be great. They had apartments before, but
okay.
Even the apartments had to go to the public hearing.
Mm-hmm.
But this workforce housing, up to 12 units in AR1, no public comments, no public hearing.
Okay. So it's a proposed change.
It is a proposed change.
Okay.
Yes.
If somebody sends me the ordinance language or whatever, I'm happy to look at it and see what how that plays out.
Okay.
Okay? All right. Sure. All right. So permitted uses, conditional uses, there's a couple other things we want to think about in the zoning world. There are special uses. All right. These are spelled out in the ordinance. So there is a section of the ordinance which says here are the special uses that are allowed in a particular zoning district. All right? And what makes them different is this is oversimplifying it a lot, but a lot of the special uses are temporary versus a conditional use that's permanent. Okay? But you can get a special use exception. You have to go to the Board of Adjustment in order to get that, right? And if it complies with the allowed special uses for that particular zoning category, Board of Adjustment can approve it. But the Board of Adjustment is going to have a hearing, so you have an opportunity to participate and raise issues that you might have about it. Variances are changes to the zoning rules for a particular parcel. Okay? The simplest example of a variance is I have a parcel and the zoning ordinance requires that to build my house I have to have 25-foot setbacks from every property line. And you know what? I got a weird shaped lot. If I do 25-foot setbacks I can't build a house, or my house is going to be bizarrely shaped or whatever. So please vary the 25-foot setback on this parcel. All right? So a variance changes some of those requirements for one particular parcel. All right? In order to do that, you've got to go to the Board of Adjustment. And there are certain criteria that you have to show in order to be able to get a variance. All right? So again, those criteria become the roadmap if you want to challenge somebody who's seeking a variance. All right? Then the last concept are what are called non-conforming uses. And a non-conforming use is a use that pre-existed a zoning regulation, and it's allowed to continue after the change. Even though it's not conforming with the new rule, because it was pre-existing, it's allowed. So this is the concept of grandfathering. All right? You might know of it that way. And as long as you keep the use the same, you can continue to not conform. Okay? There are rules built into the Article 26 talking about non-conforming uses about when you can lose non-conforming use status. And as soon as you lose it, you must conform. All right? So if I had a gas station and then the property gets zoned residential, you can't have a gas station on it. But because I pre-existed that zoning, it's okay, I can continue. But if I ever lose my non-conforming status, then it can't be a gas station anymore. All future uses would have to comply with whatever the zoning ordinance requires. Okay? So we grandfather in pre-existing uses, but as soon as those uses change enough, they got to go. Okay? That's the idea. All right? But that's what zoning's about. It's a fight about how this particular parcel is going to be used. And maybe I've got a by right permitted use, or maybe I'm going to seek a special use exception or a conditional use. All right? Maybe I need a variance to make some of these requirements, take some of the negative effect of the requirements away. Okay? But that's all the zoning world. And you see, primarily it's happening either in the planning and zoning department, the Board of Adjustment. Conditional use is the one place where you're actually going to go to the Planning Commission, and then you go to county council. All right? But that's the zoning world. Subdivisions are the other one. The planning. And again, subdivision, I've got a big parcel and I want to break it into smaller parcels because I'm going to build a whole bunch of houses. Or maybe it might be, I'm going to have, it's an industrial park. I'm going to have different industries there, whatever it might be. All right? But I'm subdividing my property from one parcel into a whole bunch of parcels. And I'm developing it. All right? Well, the process there, the roadmap is different. Basically, the developer would have to come up with a preliminary plat, a layout, a drawing. This is how it's going to be done. That gets submitted to planning and zoning. Planning and zoning then reviews that. There is a required public hearing on the preliminary plat. We're going to talk in a moment about some of the standards that apply. All right? There's a list of 17 standards in Section 99-9C. And if we're looking for roadmap of issues I can raise, that's a great example of that. Right? So there's those factors. There's also some sections that say, look, there are general design standards. There are general standards that apply, right? You got to have streets, and the streets have to meet certain minimum requirements. And you got to have sewer, and you got to have those kinds of things. All right? That's what the Planning Commission is focused on. And then the Planning Commission ultimately gives a tentative approval or disapproval of the preliminary. Okay? And then that decision by the Planning Commission can be appealed to the County Council. Okay? After that process is done, you go through a final plat, and the Planning Commission approves the final plat. So in the planning world, you're fighting mostly at the Planning Commission with then the possibility of going to County Council. Okay? That's what the roadmap tells us. Now, to give you an example of what you have, and I know this is really small to read, but I have, hopefully, we'll post the slides afterwards. These are the 17 factors that must be considered by planning and by the Planning Commission when it's looking at a preliminary plat. And the categories are things like, number one, integration of the proposed subdivision into existing terrain and surrounding landscape. It's got to blend. Minimal use of wetlands and floodplains. Number five, minimization of tree vegetation and soil removal and grade changes. Number nine, prevention of pollution of surface and groundwater. Okay? Effect on property values is 12. Effect on schools, public buildings, community facilities is 14. 17, effect on area waterways. These are all things that the Planning Commission must consider. You go down this list, and while there's lots of stuff talking about impacts to groundwater and waterways, right, there's nothing about air. Right, so if I want to raise, this can generate all these air emissions. Planning Commission, right? And I can hear Bob Wheatley saying this, right? Doesn't matter. We don't care about that because it's not on their list.
How enforceable are these? Because we see these broken all the time.
Right. So I mean, part of the issue is this gives you targets to aim at, right? But you have to understand that things like minimal use of wetlands. What's minimal, right? And you might think it's a whole lot of use of wetlands, and the Planning Commission might disagree with you, right? You can make the case, you can try to convince the Planning Commission. The Commission might disagree with you, right? But depending upon the record that is developed, that could become an issue that you appeal. All right? We'll talk about appeals a little bit shortly, but that's it. So the idea is, okay, here's my roadmap. Can I present evidence and arguments that show that one or more of these factors should lead the Planning Commission to say, you know what, we can't agree to this, we can't approve this. All right? And the Planning Commission may say, we disagree, we think that this is minimal. Okay. But by creating a record, you've now created an issue that maybe you can appeal. All right? Well, we'll talk about how that plays out when we get there. But we want to, you know, if we're using this as a roadmap, we're saying, okay, these are things that I can point to. This is why you must consider it, and here's my evidence as to why this is going to just, you know, they're failing to prevent pollution of surface and groundwater, all right? Because here it is, all right? And so that's criteria number nine. On that basis, you should say denied, all right? You should not approve. That's the idea, all right? But at least this way, right, this roadmap allows you to say, okay, I'm going to talk in words that the Planning Commission understands, because the Planning Commission has to. They have to comply with this. That's the idea, all right? Okay.
But back to her question then.
Yeah.
What if they don't comply by that?
Well, so here's the thing. There's two ways they could not comply, right? Number one is they just don't do it, right? So they don't consider it at all, right? And so then the appeal, right, says they failed to consider factor 9, 12, 15, right? And if they really have failed to consider it, that's a pretty easy reversal, okay? The harder part, and what they will inevitably do, is they'll say, oh, we've considered it, but we it meets it. Oh, we've considered, oh, but it meets it, right? And you think it doesn't, right? That's a factual issue where we're going to have to look at the record that was before the Planning Commission, right? And if the only thing before the Planning Commission is a bunch of evidence which says that they aren't preventing pollution of surface water, and they say, oh, but we think it does, then you have a factual basis to appeal by saying, look, there's no evidence in the record to support your conclusion that that's okay.
But
that's the idea.
That's before it's permitted. I mean, once it's permitted and they have this thing, what if then they just ignore all 17 of those and do whatever they want to do? Then what do you do?
Well, this stuff has to be built into the plan, right? So if they ignore the plan, right, or they fail to do this stuff, right, during the construction process, they come back with a final plat, you could say, wait a minute, time out, you didn't comply with the approval for the preliminary plat, right? So you can challenge it in that grounds. Failing that, we're going to have to find a different cause of action outside of the planning process about the pollution that's being created. Okay?
Right, that's the question.
Yeah.
Okay, question. So we've got these 17 factors. There's another document that I'm not quite sure where it fits into all of this, and that's the county comprehensive plan.
Right.
Because in many cases, it touches on how these are to be carried out in some cases. For example,
right.
You know, you're talking about not changing grade or, you know, mm-hmm. sitting with the landscape. There's a whole sorts of things about, you know, congruence with the existing neighborhood.
Right.
In the comprehensive plan. Their general attitude seems to be that despite the fact the comprehensive plan begins with this has force of law, it's generally ignored.
Yeah, and so the general rule is that the decisions have to comply with the comprehensive plan.
Right.
And so to the extent that they do one of these things that is inconsistent with. So they say, yeah, okay, we considered it, we're going to do this. So like, wait a minute, it's inconsistent with the plan. That then becomes a basis to challenge. All right? So the comprehensive plan provides guardrails, right, as to how these things have to be considered. Right? And so the argument would be, they didn't consider it because the comprehensive plan says you have to do X, and they didn't do X. Or they haven't thought about, or this is not X, this is anti-X, right? And so therefore, their approval, right? The basic thing, right, if you're going to appeal a decision, it's going to be on the basis of one of three grounds. Either the decision is arbitrary and capricious, clearly contrary to law, or not supported by substantial evidence in the record. Those are the three bases. And so, arbitrary and capricious would probably be, right, and you'd argue it's contrary to law because there is law which says comprehensive plan, you know, you need to comply with it. But it's also going to be arbitrary and capricious for them to say, well, we've approved this because they're acting in a way that violates the comprehensive plan. So you argue, hey, that's in and of itself a ground. Okay? So, yeah, they ignore it, and they will continue to ignore it until somebody challenges it and says, no, that you can't do that, and get a judge to agree.
I know you're going to come back to appeals, so I'll hold this. You know, it seems very difficult to find the place to have the appropriate appeal.
Yeah, and part of it is because the roadmaps, like there's a little bit of intersection, but yeah, so hopefully we can sort that out a little bit tonight.
Okay.
Yeah.
About the comprehensive plan?
We often run into the problem of nonprofit or nonprofit groups who are supported by state funding will not speak for us. However, they give us the information to take before planning and zoning.
Mm-hmm.
And no matter who stands up there or what their they're told we don't have the proper credentials. They're listening to the engineers and the attorneys and the developers who know what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Is the only recourse an appeal?
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, and you have to think in terms of, can I avoid that or can I contest that, right? So obviously one way would be I've got my own experts, right? That would be the best way. But yeah, sure, it's real easy to get experts, right? So then you've got to, you know, the second argument is to say, well, this is evidence that is generated by people who are, you know, so let's say you've got a report or something like that. It's like these people themselves are experts. And so all we're doing is we're taking their expert opinions and we're giving it to you. So yeah, that's a tough one. That's a tough one to fight simply because the developers have the money to pay for some, you know, shill to say what needs to be said, right? And so how do you confront that? How do you respond to that?
Another problem we have is even if we have money to hire the experts,
mm-hmm.
if the property owner does not allow our expert to get into their parcel to survey or, you know, get the delineation of the wetlands,
mm-hmm.
we cannot have our expert get in there because property owners, they oftentimes check the mark when they say, would you allow the dendrite employees to get, you know, to survey your lot?
Mm-hmm.
No. Would you allow Army Corps to survey? No. So would they allow the private experts to go into their parcel to delineate wetland? Because delineation of the wetland is the biggest issue right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I haven't looked at that issue in particular. In terms of whether or not there is some way to force that to happen. I'd have to think about that one.
Yeah.
But that's a tough one.
In a recent case, one parcel was 150 acres. And they, in 2019, they applied for the PLUS review, said 30 acres of regulated non-tidal wetlands.
Mm-hmm.
And then they withdrew it and then submitted again for 4.87. That's mm-hmm. after Trump administration got rid of the waters of the U.S. and put the navigable water protection rule. So now it's 4.87 from 30, but in their own application for the pre-application meeting with the planning and zoning, they had the they declared 76.37 acres of mm-hmm. forested wetlands.
Right.
So apparently more than half of the whole parcel is a forested wetland, but only 4.87 is jurisdictional non-tidal wetlands. So from 76 to 5, how does that happen?
By the definition.
Yes, and that's done by their expert.
Right, and so you'd have to challenge the definition, and you know, it's kind of an interesting. Delaware has this bizarre situation, right? It doesn't exist in Pennsylvania, but it has this bizarre situation where Delaware, the feds regulate jurisdictional wetlands, and jurisdictional wetlands are wetlands that are connected to waters of the United States. Could be tidal, could be non-tidal, okay? But there's been a fight for the last 30 some odd years about how do you define what is a wetland that is subject to the Clean Water Act. Delaware has state regulations for tidal wetlands. It has no state regulations for non-tidal wetlands. And the effect is, if something is not under federal jurisdiction and it's not tidal, it's like Wild West. That's a regulatory gap that no one has challenged yet. Right?
We have talked with DENREC and also Army Corps and asked them, who is delineating this wetland? Where is the authority? Who has the absolute map? The answer we got was DENREC has no boot on the ground to send to survey.
Right.
Army Corps doesn't either. So only thing they rely on is the applicant's expert.
Right.
Whatever they submit, they sign off.
Yeah, sometimes the Army Corps will come out and look, but they won't do their own delineation. They'll just kind of like, yeah, that's right. No, that's not. But yeah, yeah. It's a problem when the developer has a very clear incentive, right, to minimize the wetlands. And it's their person who's making that call. Right. But whether or not there's a way to challenge that sort of gap, there may be a way. I got to think about it, but there may be a way.
In a matter I was involved with, we didn't do it because we could not raise the money necessary to take it on. But when you get into those issues where it's a question of fairness, i.e. you can't get in to the property, so you can't make it contradictory. One of the avenues that's unique in Delaware is we have a court of equity. Is that something that could go to the court of equity to say, look, you guys are making a decision. We believe it's wrong, but we've not been given permission to go take a look. Could the court of equity actually, or could our chancery court...
I don't know about that. I don't know about that one.
And I don't either. I mean,
yeah.
I'm just raising it as a theory.
Yeah. I don't know if the Court of Chancery would get into that. But that's a good question. Because I just haven't thought about it.
Fairness is their playground.
Right. Okay, you guys have given me lots to think about already. All right.
About the point 9 on that there, about the groundwater.
Yeah.
What happened recently, within the last month, is county approved a big project that's happening right outside of the town of city of Lewis on the wellhead protection area and the excellent recharge area. So the Lewis Public Works came and protested, but they cannot do anything. It's not their land. It doesn't belong to the city. It belongs to the county. So county, you know, they can allow that. And another thing is, there is a royal farm on Coastal Highway, Seaside Highway. In front of it is the royal farm. And the royal farm is sitting square in the middle of the wellhead protection area and excellent recharge area, and it's only a few hundred feet away from the Hovis public well. And I had to go through the FOIA to get that information. But that's what's happening in here.
Right.
How are they protecting our drinking water?
Right.
You've got to go EPA on something like that. You have to take it out of state because the state won't help.
EPA won't intercede in Delaware. They gave DENREC the right to do all their work.
Yes. Yeah, but then...
But you can, if you've got the political clout to get them to call us, because if you can get Harper's office to make the call, which they've done.
Well, I talked to Gavin, what's his name, DENREC secretary, and also Harper, Carney. And poorly zip, nothing. I handed them in person the report.
But what I'm saying is, on that kind of issue, you need to go to Carver. Or you need to go, you know, to PROMESA. But you've got to go to someone who's on the federal side and say, look, here is a clear abuse of the Clean Water Act. This is drinking water, which EPA has. And yes, EPA has given DENRIC responsibility. But if they're not exercising that responsibility, a senator or a congressman calling the EPA and saying, I'm going to take this to the floor.
We petitioned the EPA to remove DENRIC's right to administer the Clean Water Act, and the EPA killed it. They've hidden it somewhere.
But that's why I'm saying at that point you do have to make it a political issue, and you have to get a champion who's in Congress who basically said, if you do not do this, I'm going to take this to the floor. EPA does not like congressional floor fights over their issues.
Yeah.
And that unfortunately, it's a threat. But yeah. You have to be able to get it to someone who's willing to make the threat.
Yeah.
Okay. That's a good thought, Marty.
I mean,
okay.
Having done it, I can tell you it does.
That we can kind of talk to you after this, because I'm dealing with an extremely serious issue that I'm getting zero effort from anyone.
Well, again,
literally.
Yes, I'd be happy to chat with you about the experience. Now, it was Maryland, but it was almost a parallel situation. Maryland National Resources is also given control over their control. And this was a public school dependent on well water. And they were going to allow development in the face of that well. And there was a former chromate mine on the other side of the hill, which they were proposing to use spoil from to grade over the resource. Chrome and drinking water doesn't go well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, okay. All right, so let me just kind of get back, but we're talking about some good stuff, and some of the issues are coming up, okay? So we've identified some different areas where you can participate in the process, all right? And it's set forth more in the Citizen's Guide, all right? But a couple of things about participating in the process. Number one, I say do your homework, meaning you need to come prepared with the facts that support the position you want to take. One of the things that I see sometimes at public hearings is citizens stand up and they have questions. Hey, what are you going to do about X? Right? Perfectly legitimate question, but when it's put in the form of a question, DENRIC says, oh, well, we're going to do everything necessary to protect the environment and, you know, that kind of BS, and we've answered the question, all right? Instead, I think you have to come in and I think you have to be able to say, look, here's how you're going, you know, you are going to violate provision X of the ordinance or, you know, whatever. And here's the evidence to support that. All right? Now it's not just, oh, we're going to do whatever. Now they have to confront a factual basis and try to rebut the information that you've brought. Okay, it's a stronger position. But in order to do that, you got to do the homework. You got to find the stuff. You got to be able to present that to the relevant decision maker. All right? Second, you got to remember MAP rule number 2, which is you're only going to talk about issues that this particular decision maker focuses on. Talking about other issues isn't going to move that decision maker because they're just going to say, that ain't our bailiwick, so we're not going to listen to you. All right? So you can just, you know, don't waste the time. Most importantly, what you want to do, though, is you want to make as complete a record as possible. Right? So if you have support that comes from the Inland Bays, Center for the Inland Bays, right? That's probably one, that's who I thought of when you said that. Say, here it is. You know, and here I want to make this. Here I want to give this to you. I want to make this part of the record of this proceeding, right? Because when you appeal, the record that was created before the agency is what the appellate body is limited to. So if you haven't made a factual record, you can't then try to make it later. Okay? So you got to make it during the times that you have public comment or, you know, at a public hearing, you want to raise those issues. My suggestion is, although it's a little extra work, written is better than spoken. And the reason why is because spoken tends to be limited in time. You get 3 minutes. You can't say much in 3 minutes. But when you've got 20 pages, you know, and you submit it in writing, right? And you can stand up and you can say, look, I have written comments here. I'm submitting them. I want them part of the record. I did that in under 3 minutes, but I've now produced 20 pages worth of information that I want the decision maker to have in the record. Okay? That helps to make a better case. Does that mean you'll win? No. But you've got to be thinking about, right, how am I going to have the ammo I need down the road? When perhaps a person who is not as involved, invested, whatever you want to call it, you know, like a judge at the Superior Court, you know, you want to have that information, those arguments made and available. I just finished arguing an appeal of a zoning decision up in Pennsylvania where I did not do the hearing before the zoning hearing board. And so I'm up on appeal and I'm like, I really wish they would have said this or put this evidence on or whatever, because that would have made the appeal stronger. But I can't add it. It's too late. All right? So you want to do it the first time through. All right. Now, let's talk about appeals. All right? In the zoning world, the process is application to a zoning decision. All right? That's usually made by that decision is usually made by the zoning and planning department. Right? Now, if you got a conditional use or something like that, it's different. All right? But setting aside conditional uses, which are going to the county council, everything else is basically going to go, a decision's made, you can appeal that decision to the Board of Adjustment. The Board of Adjustment decision can then be appealed to the Superior Court, and you can appeal the Superior Court decision to the Supreme Court. Okay? The one thing that I don't have here, but it's kind of picked up in a similar way here. In planning, you have the application, you got the Planning Commission making a recommendation to the County Council, who then formally approves. The County Council's decision can be appealed to the Superior Court and then to the Supreme Court. Okay? And that's the same, that notion of County Council makes a decision on a conditional use in the zoning context, you can then appeal that to the Superior Court. All right? State permitting, which we haven't talked about, but in the DENREC world, you've got an application, there's going to be an opportunity for public comment, you can request a public hearing. If DENREC grants that, you can then go to the hearing. DENREC then issues a permit. Here, the appeal of that permit goes to the Environmental Appeals Board. Their decision can then be appealed to the Superior Court and then to the Supreme Court. I know it's a lot of info, but again, the slides will be posted, so you can have those. Yeah.
So once it goes to the public comment period, how do you get informed that a permit was issued?
A couple of different ways. One is that I think, if nothing else is a courtesy, I think DENREC informs anyone who submitted public comments of a decision. No? Okay, that's kind of been my experience. But DENREC has a a listserv that you can sign up for that will tell you when permit decisions are made. And you can then, you know, you just watch out for the permit that you care about, and then you know. And it's kind of important, right? Because in any of these appeals, one of the important issues is timing. Is that the next one here? Yeah. The general rule on most of the zoning and planning stuff is you got 30 days. All right? But in the state context, you only have 20. Okay? And if you want to get really this sucks, at the state level, if the permit is under the Coastal Zone Act, you've got 15 days. Okay? So you got to watch the timing. All right? But you file your appeal with, you know, the roadmap on the previous chart, the previous slide. Okay? Generally, the 30 days is going to run from the time a written decision is issued. So even though you might have a vote, it has to be in writing, and that tends to set off the clock. Okay? You need to appeal to the right forum, and again, the previous slide kind of tells you what the next step is, where you go. All right? And sometimes that can be confusing, right? Especially if you get some off-the-wall action by one of the players. Right? But you want to appeal to the right forum. You can only raise the issues that were raised below. That's why you want to make as complete a record as you can, so that you have raised the issues you want to raise on appeal. You raise them below, because you're going to be limited to that in your appeal. You need to make sure that you name as a party the property owner, as well as the permit, or, you know, the applicant. Failure to do that can get your appeal tossed. Okay, so you want to make sure that you do that. An individual can appeal in their own name. An organization can only appeal in its name if it's represented by counsel. Okay? An individual, you can just fill out the form, file an appeal without having an attorney involved. But organizations must be represented by counsel. Okay? And two special things that exist that are ways to affect the process. They are two different writs that are available in the Superior Court. One is called the writ of mandamus. The writ of mandamus is a writ which forces a governmental decision maker to act, to perform a non-discretionary duty. Okay? So if, for example, when you file an appeal for the Board of Adjustment, you file it with the, in Sussex, you file it with the director of the Planning and Zoning Department. And by statute, the director is required to then pass that appeal onto the Board of Adjustment. If for some reason the director doesn't do that, a writ of mandamus is a way of getting a court to say, you're required to do this, do it, send it to the board. Right? But what's essential about that is it's got to be a non-discretionary duty, right? So you can't bring a writ of mandamus against DENREC saying, hey, enforce the law, because enforcement is discretionary. All right? You have to find some non-discretionary duty that the government actor is not performing, and the court can tell them, go perform it. All right? So kind of a limited scope. The other is the writ of certiorari. And that is the method by which you raise It's kind of an appeal to the Superior Court when you don't otherwise have the right to appeal. When you say, because basically what the writ of certiorari says is, Judge, there is some error of law here, and you need to make them comply with the law. All right? And so you have to have a final decision in order to be able to bring it. You have to have exhausted all the administrative remedies. So if planning and zoning issues a recommendation to approve a preliminary subdivision plat, you can't run off and bring a writ of certiorari because you have the ability to appeal to the county council. Right, so you got to make sure that there's no other place you can go, but then you can ask the judge to look at, is this really in compliance with the law? That's really what the writ of certiorari does. And so it's one other way to get a review. Okay? It's not easy to sort all this stuff out. Okay. My suggestion is give me a call and we'll talk. Okay? But that's available to you. All right, now, a couple of reality checks. Number one, the other side ain't dumb. They've got attorneys, they've got experts, people who do this stuff all the time, they know. All right? Rare is the situation where someone is going to just forget to do one of the legal requirements. All right? Developers are going to have attorneys who are going to say, okay, there's 17 factors here. Let me tell you how we meet each one of those factors. All right? They might be telling you stuff that isn't very persuasive, but they're going to try to throw stuff out there because, hey, we're trying to create a record. So, rare is the time that you will find, just a real flub. All right? That doesn't mean you don't appeal. That doesn't mean you don't fight. But it's just you have to understand that, there's moneyed people on the other side who have a huge incentive to make this thing happen. And so they are going to look at the law, try to comply with the law, tell you, argue as to why they are in compliance with the law, all that's going to happen. Okay? You just have to recognize that that's part of the process. The second reality check is the difference between how courts will look at appeals based on legal issues versus factual issues. And here's the distinction that I draw. A legal issue is one about simply what does the law require, and a failure, for example, to do what the law requires, that's an error of law. All right? What's good about errors of law in an appeal context is that the court is not bound by or have to give deference to the prior decision maker. Okay? In contrast, factual issues. Courts have a more deferential review. They will say, look, is there any substantial evidence in the record to support the decision? Even if we might reach a different decision based on the evidence in the record, is there substantial evidence? And you know how courts describe or define substantial evidence for purposes of this rule? Is there one piece of evidence that supports it? If so, we're not going to mess with it. We're not going to second guess. Okay? That's why factual issues are so hard to win. Not impossible, but really hard. Okay, and you just have to understand that. Right? That's why I'm making a record and putting all the stuff in there. You might be able to create a thing which says, no, there is nothing in the record that supports the conclusion. Therefore, they got the facts wrong. Okay? But you have to understand that that's there. And the other sort of reality check is you got to jump through all the hoops. It may feel like, you know, the Planning Commission, the council, you know, everybody seems to be rejecting your arguments, rejecting your position. You just have to keep plowing ahead. You don't give up. Okay? Because you keep going, you keep fighting the fight, and then you might get to a place where a superior court judge who doesn't have the same perspective on things that, say, a county commissioner does, or, you know, a supervisor, will say, no, that's crazy. You know, that decision has to be overturned, right? But you only get there by continuing to fight the fight and jumping through the hoops to get yourself in front of that perhaps more sympathetic or more objective, or there's lots of different ways you can describe it, but a decision maker who might be more willing to listen to what you have to say.
What is the cost?
The what?
The cost. The cost.
How much does
it cost
you? Well, so the cost, you know, you have to pay a filing fee to file an appeal. I think they're $300. Okay? If you are going to have an expert because you have certain issues that you want the expert to testify to, you got to pay the expert or find somebody who will do it for free, but there aren't a lot of those out there, right? But there might be some who would do it for reduced rates, right? And then the third one is attorney's fees, and you know what? I don't charge.
There's also a transcript fee.
The what?
Transcript of the public hearing.
That's true.
That costs about $3,000 for us.
Well, it kind of depends on how long the transcript is. The transcript could be a couple of grand. Those are those costs, right? So you got to pick your fights, right? And I want to help, but you know, sometimes the distinction that I often draw is the distinction between, you know, there are legal issues, right? The compliance stuff, the factual stuff about whether or not things are met, right? And then there are political issues, right? And the politics of getting decision makers to see things in a political way, that it politically matters to them that they do the right thing. And that's something that I'm terrible at. But you all are voters, and you all have the ability to sort of put the fear of the voting booth, perhaps, into the minds of the decision makers, right? But there are ways to attack this. They won't always work, but there are some that will, right? And what we have to do is sort of persevere and fight through it and do the best we can and see if we can make some changes.
Can I make one more statement?
Sure.
I might. And that is, when you lose, because very often you fight all the way through and you lose, you don't stop. Because there are, you know, as Ken outlined here, there are a variety of procedural things that are going to happen after they get their planning permission. And you show up for those when you can, you comment on them, and frankly, you find fault with everything they're doing. And we think, in my immediate area, which is on White's Neck, which is just outside of Ocean View in Millville. We think we forced the developer to sell a property because we just made his life difficult enough to somebody who was willing to do something more in keeping with the surrounding community. But we harassed him for 2.5 years. He didn't cut his grass. We called the county constable. He had a building that had asbestos shingle that was breaking down. We called Denrec and said, this is a threat to water. He got fed up. I believe that's what happened.
Yeah, and I think I think that that's that persistence, right? That seeing it through, right? And also recognize that, okay, you may lose the fight at the zoning or the planning level, but there's in all likelihood going to be a fight at the Denrec level, all right? And different factors and different things come into play there. So there might be multiple fronts in the war. And planning and zoning is an important part of it, but it's not the only part of it. Almost any of these developments, even a residential development, it's going to have stormwater issues and things like that, and that then becomes a place where you can make arguments to Denrec. Now, that may not, you know, Denrec's not going to say, well, what's the traffic situation, right? I mean, that's not on the Denrec roadmap, right? Where it would be in the on the county roadmap. But nevertheless, you could say, okay, well, let's talk about the stormwater, and the stormwater isn't going to work, and here's the reasons why, and we can fight about that, right? And sometimes, it's not always, but sometimes those fights can lead to decisions that ultimately, you know, you can consider to be wins, okay? I had a case in Pennsylvania. It went on for, 5 or 6 years. Someone wanted to build a road course, 3.2-mile road course, and it was going to be part of a club, private club, that people could pay. Now, this was back in 06 or 07. I don't know what it would be today. People could pay $40,000 a year to be a member of the club so that they could bring their Porsche or whatever and drive it only 55 miles an hour around the road course. Okay? And we represented, the clinic represented property owners who were next to this, and they were like, this is going to be crazy. And we challenged it. We challenged the stormwater permit. We got the permit remanded. 2 years later, they issued another permit with a completely different layout. We challenged that. And ultimately, we lost that challenge. But because it took so long, the developer had to go get investors to provide the money to keep this dream alive. And by the time the second appeal was over, the investors were like, forget it, we want out. They sold the land to the state, and it became state game land. So the investors got their money back, made a little bit of profit, and the thing was never built. Right? That strategy doesn't work everywhere. I'm not a big fan of the let's stall them and maybe they'll go away strategy, but sometimes that just happens. Because you're fighting the fight. All right? And so my advice is don't give up. All right? Develop a strategy, attack this. You aren't always going to win, but don't give up. All right? One more question.
Yes, recently planning and zoning denied a subdivision that was a very rare case, but they did. And everybody thought it was going to be approved.
Uh-huh.
And the developer actually bought the land the day before they made the decision, thinking that they got it.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so they appealed. And the council said, well, this was not done logically because a commissioner made a motion to approve and read a whole bunch of lists of why it should be approved. And when they called the vote, she said no, and everybody else said no, and only the chair said yes, so mm-hmm. it was denied.
Mm-hmm.
But they did not give the reason for the denial.
Mm-hmm.
So the council sent it back. So we're looking at it. Now, we are coming up with, trying to come up with the reasons why, I mean, to provide the reasons to the Planning and Zoning Commissioners why they denied. And one was the superior design of the cluster ordinance. Superior design requires certain categories and not building near the wetland and things like that. Mm-hmm. So we were making that argument
okay.
and sent out to papers, all the newspapers. Somebody got hold of that and came back and said, you guys should do your study. This subdivision was submitted before the superior design became in effect. So it does not apply.
Okay.
However, when we go back to the public hearing, the applicant's lawyer is talking about
mm-hmm.
how this one fits or complies with the superior design, even though it, you know, they did not have to.
Yeah.
So can we still go back to that and say, well, applicant's lawyer said it complies with it, but actually doesn't?
Yeah, so, you know, the argument is the applicant sort of put it at issue, right, raised it. Whether or not, though, that could become the basis, if it was passed afterwards, you know, from a separate legal perspective, my advice would be come up with another reason. Keep that one, but come up with another. Have a backup. Right? The more you got, the better.
There will be more opportunity after the preacher went off. Ken, Professor, we appreciate you coming.
Thanks for having me.